Welcome to Hidden Layers, where we explore the people and technology behind artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Ron Green, and today we have a special episode. Joining me is my co-founder, distinguished engineer, and all-around AI wizard, Zizisa. Zizi and I have had the privilege of witnessing the AI revolution in computer vision firsthand. We've seen it grow from a niche academic discipline into a worldwide transformative technology. In this episode, we're going to share our experiences building early systems and what it was like living through the deep learning revolution. And because we're not just about nostalgia, we're also going to give you a peek into the future of AI and what we're most excited about. Zizi earned his PhD in statistics at UCLA, where his research focused on generative hierarchical models for object recognition. He's published widely, including in the International Conference on Computer Vision, Conference on Computer Vision and Pattern Recognition, and the IEEE Transactions on Pattern Analysis and Machine Intelligence. His paper on generative modeling received the Mar Prize Honorable Mention, one of the highest honors in the computer vision community. His professional work includes algorithmic ad targeting at Apple, search ranking at Google, product search and matching at Impossible Ventures, generative modeling at Vicarious AI, and deep learning applications for image understanding and chatbots at HomeAway Expedia. Before UCLA, he earned his BS in computer science at Tsinghua University. Zizi, thanks for being here. I'm really excited.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ron. I think it's fun to reach into our memories and super happy to chat about computer vision and our experiences.
So you are one of the few people I know who's been working in computer vision professionally and academically, both before and after the deep learning revolution. Mm. And so, you know, I was doing computer vision work back in the 90s, and it was just a completely different game back
Amazing.
Then. I got out of the computer vision game a little bit in the 2000s, but you were there. You were there during the wave of transition from sort of, you know, handcrafted features into deep learning-based systems.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be just a ball to go back and talk about what it was like living through that, arguably one of the most important technological revolutions in human history.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let me tee this up. Let's start at the beginning. How did you get interested in computer vision in the first place?
My undergrad was from like 2002 to 2006. And I think I was during my last year, during my senior year, I got exposed to computer vision by going to the research lab at Tsinghua. I think it's called the AI lab. And we were doing one of the competitions called NIST competition. It's an image retrieval task where I use like back of words, like back of visual words, and then use a SVM on top of that,
right,
to predict which images is the most relevant to the query. So that's the, like, you know, I immediately got super interested into computer vision. So that's kind of my foray into the field.
Okay, so I think everybody listening today would be kind of curious, what was it like? So you're building, you know, image recognition. Recognition systems, yeah, back in the early 2000s, obviously no deep learning techniques. What were you doing? What was the feature engineering work like?
There are a lot of very sophisticated features that's designed by smart scientists and engineers like SIFT, the scale invariant feature transforms, and HOG. I think it's called the histogram of gradients. It's very well-designed features that will describe a kind of a local region of image. It takes a long time to design. They work really well. They're fast. And then, you know, after describing, you know, after extracting key points from the image, you use the like SIFT and HOG like descriptor to describe those regions. And then you put a classifier on top. And at that time, the popular one was the support vector machines or AdaBoost.
Right.
And there's a lot of tuning on the hyperparameters of the features as well as the support vector machines. So rather than, like, you know, having a very deep understanding of the image, it's really tweaking the parameters and watch if your rank on that competition on the leaderboard will increase or not. It's pretty fun. It's a but I feel like, you know, it's very parameter tuning heavy.
Right.
Which is why I, you know, later got into my PhD study under my advisors, Sun Chenzhu and Yinian Wu, to try to build a statistical model for understanding images.
Right. And you were really interested in sort of the deeper understanding of images, not just sort of necessarily scoring well on some of these metrics, but you were interested in the science and research of how to build computer vision systems that understood in a deep way. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so during that time, I read a paper about image parsing, which is to like really understand image data, like what's in the image. Like if you're, you know, as a human, how do we understand image? And that paper is about like parsing or decomposing image into the low entropy structure, which is kind of like line strokes, outlines, those very high level structures. And then the high entropy kind of texture, which is the fine details, like the chaotic, the randomness of, you know, different lighting, different little textures. So that really got me into more statistical modeling approaches of computer vision.
And what was that like? What were those techniques? I have almost no experience with sort of statistical-based computer vision modeling.
Yeah, so we're trying to, so in my PhD study, I was trying to teach machines to understand image like human. So I think human has a very abstract way of understanding visual signals. It's a very abstract way. So like, you know, when you try to describe an owl, well, human can draw an owl with just a few strokes. You know, step one, you draw the circle for the head and circle for the body. And step two, you draw the eyes, the foot, and then of course the step three is like, you know, all the right, all the fun details, textures. But you know, even step one and step two, the few strokes is enough to tell that it's owl.
Right.
So we try to teach the machine to do that, and I worked on the sparse model, sparse coding, and also Bayesian inference, where we try to have the model learn from just a few examples, like three or five images, and try to learn the abstract representation of an object. And at that time, I was working with the data sets. Like, you know, when I collected the data sets, I used the animal heads, and my friends would come around and say, oh, Zizi, are you studying zoology? But yeah, we're, you know, trying to learn models to represent natural objects.
And were the images you used, did you do something like contour line detection and then just take out everything except for the hard contours to get the outlines for the input data? Or what were you doing?
Yeah, so we used Garbled wavelets.
Right.
So, you know, those filter banks that are like, you know, local line strokes at different orientations. So we do convolution, we do max pooling, we do another convolution to extract out the parts, and then another max pooling.
Yeah.
You may feel like these terms are familiar. It's also used in ComNets.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny. So as a part of this statistical modeling, you were still using kernels, you're still using convolutions,
right.
You were still doing some of these sort of translation invariant techniques as a part of that. But was that only for the image generation, or was any of that used in the modeling as well?
Mm. So we mainly maximize the likelihood on the image. So it's to generate image, to reconstruct image, but not to the fine details like the GANs or the diffusion models now, but rather to reconstruct like, hey, very abstract sketches which look like that animal. And there's also a lot of latent variables because, you know, the shape will deform. So we use the latent variables to represent the deformation there. So there's a lot of EM algorithm, the expectation maximization algorithm, which is very, it's very beautiful mathematically, but it had a very, had a lot of challenge making them work large scale. Like the learning is not very fast. There's no like stochastic gradient descent type of algorithm to scale it to millions of images. That part is really hard. So we were able to detect like objects like horses, cars, at a pretty good accuracy, kind of, you know, on par with the state of art at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But then it kind of plateaued because we cannot scale to millions of images.
Right. Is this when you first got interested in sort of generative modeling?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I feel like, you know, I really have a thing for generative modeling and unsupervised learning.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And Ram, also curious about your experience. I really wanted to learn about, you know, what things are like in the 90s when you're working with neural nets.
That's a great question. In the 90s, the neural networks we built and trained were tiny in comparison now. Mm. I mean, you know, billions or trillions of times smaller. And we were training on machines without GPUs. All we had were CPUs. And those CPUs, I remember being very excited when we had got access to a 20 megahertz CPU, you know, mm-hmm. orders of magnitude, you know, slower than your iPhone here. Yeah. Everything back then was handcrafted. Everything was built in C because obviously speed was so critical. Yeah. We couldn't afford to do anything in higher order languages. There were no frameworks. There was nothing. Mm. There was nothing that you really had access to except for just starting with an empty file and crafting things from scratch. Mm. And I think the things that is most surprising to people that when I talk to them now that work in AI is that because we have these like auto differentiation libraries, mm. like PyTorch and TensorFlow and JAX, et cetera, you can create arbitrarily complex sort of processing pipelines, and you can put together arbitrarily complex transformations or mathematical operations, and you don't have to worry about how that will be translated into the gradient descent back propagation operation mm. because we have auto differentiation.
Yeah.
Well, back then, one of the challenges was any changes you made to the pipeline meant you had to literally break out a sheet of paper and a pencil and recalculate right. the gradient and the differential equations from scratch. So what that meant was it was really difficult to experiment broadly because you were kind of confined. Once you committed to certain designs, you kind of felt locked in. Mm. And the other thing, when I look back on the 90s, the number one mistake that I think we made that's just astounding in retrospect is we used sigmoid activations for everything. We used them for the hidden layers as well, which we now know is really problematic because it leads to vanishing and exploding gradients. But back then, all of the work within neural networks was predicated to a greater or lesser extent on some mathematical proofs that had shown that they were universal function approximators. Mm-hmm. And so we felt very confident that we could model anything based upon that paper, but that paper assumed certain architectural constraints, so we didn't want to leave them. We didn't want to try things like ReLU because it wasn't clear if you had something that was only point-wise differentiable, if you might throw away that entire edifice on which you'd built. So it was sort of unimaginably archaic compared to what we do now.
Amazing.
And I would never want to go back.
I feel lucky with the deep learning frameworks. So every time when you change the network architecture, you need to manually, on paper, derive the gradients in math.
That's exactly
right.
And then
implement it back in C, I guess. What's the tool like?
There was no code generation. Now, we did have Wolfram. If you were lucky enough, you might have a copy of that. You could go get the CD and run it locally. There was no web access, or you had MATLAB or something like that. Mm. But it was still complex because, we can do all kinds of weird things now as far as how the signal flows through the models, and not even have to be concerned at all about how that might affect the ending function, because, you know, conceptually it's just some giant function we're computing, some giant nested function. Well, it's hard to understand how that might disrupt that. And then you could calculate, you know, your derivatives incorrectly and your gradients made no sense. So, all right. So I want to ask you, how did you react? I wasn't working in computer vision. In 2012, when AlexNet happened, and it just, you know, set the context for anybody who may not be familiar with this. AlexNet was the first deep learning based computer vision model that really had a strong impact on the scene because it performed exceptionally well on a competition called ImageNet. And what's important about this is that prior to this 2012 release, most of the architectures that were submitted for competition were sort of hand-tuned, feature-engineered solutions like you were describing a moment ago. And AlexNet came in and was this neural network-based, you know, quote-unquote, deep learning approach, although now we would consider it pretty shallow in hindsight, even though this was only, you know, 12 years ago. But it just blew away the competition. And all of the features, meaning all of the signal information that the classifier eventually used to make determinations was calculated automatically through the training process on the model. So this was a sea change to best practices at the time. I would love to hear, what did you think? What did your colleagues think? What did your professors think when you saw the paper? And I know that you also were good friends with the lead author on the ImageNet paper. True. So tell me about that whole experience. What was that like and what were you thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. That was wild. You know, I graduated my PhD in 2011.
Right.
And when AlexNet came out, I was working at Google, and I was actually in a tech talk. I think it's Alex giving a talk. You know, it's you know, hosted by Google Brain, or Jeff Dean was the host at that time, and Alex gave a talk about using ComNets for street number detection and segmentation. And the accuracy was over the roof, you know, compared to the numbers that I was used to before.
Right.
And I was really amazed. And another impression was that, you know, it takes so much resource to train. I think it was using disbelief at that time. That's the precursor before TensorFlow. On thousands of machines, I believe. So very resource intensive, but super accurate. And honestly, I mean, deep learning, ComNets for computer vision, it means a lot. It automates the feature design, which was really painful in the 2010s, I would say.
What did you think about that, though? I mean, I've talked to people who were disappointed a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were like, that so much of their academic focus was on the feature engineering part. Like, were you a little disappointed, or were you excited?
Oh, absolutely. There's definitely emotional component to that. I mean, we talk about AI replacing jobs. You know, which jobs were first replaced? It's the very job of AI researchers in computer vision. Yeah, I mean, since feature design is automated now. But I mean, it's definitely for the good. So in a 2010s, when we, because one of the hard problems of vision is the hierarchy, like from objects to the primitives, like the edges, there's a lot of layers that you need to go through. You need to group edges into small parts and to bigger parts, and then to, like, you know, larger parts, and then to objects. The design space is so large. You need to design the features, make sure your code is bug-free there. You need to have a learning algorithm for, you know, grouping the features into parts. You know, it's just so complicated. But with the deep learning, with the ComNets, a lot of that is automated away,
right,
and you don't have to care about that a lot. And your design space shifted from features to network architectures and loss functions and stuff like that. So yeah, definitely a major change.
Did you have any of the people you worked with, either professors or other students or colleagues at work, that dismissed it out of hand?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we probably both have, you know, heard stories like that. Because deep, like ComNets, RNNs, or deep learning were not very popular before 2012.
Right.
So the dominating methods then was, like, you know, support vector machines, graphical model, Bayesian graphical models, a lot of, you know, bleed propagation, you know, stuff like that. And things like deep learning with so many parameters trained on even millions of images, you know, compared to the parameters, it's still a small data set compared to the number of parameters. So right. such models shouldn't work.
Right.
Like, you know, if you ask a statistician, this is like, you know, how could this happen?
It's just over-parameterized.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So it shouldn't work, but, you know, in reality, it actually works.
In theory, it shouldn't work.
Yeah.
But in actuality, it does.
And a lot of things that feels hacky, like the ReLU and other, like, you know, pooling, you know, different engineering components in it.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily derive from first principles. It's a very smart design. But
they feel like hacks almost.
Yeah, they almost feel like hacks. So, right. you know, kind of like the popular opinion then, before seeing the real success is that, why should it work? Don't spend time on it.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You know, it's so funny. In the 90s, that was the same sentiment. It was this sense that if it did work, it was just kind of luck, but it wasn't really principled. It was this sense that a bunch of things are being tried, but it's not scientific. It was almost more like experimental scattershot engineering instead, right? And I agree with you. I think things like, you know, ReLU, first time I saw that, I thought it was crazy. I mean, I just thought that was nuts. Right. A dropout makes no sense. You know, theoretically, I this idea of just turning off neurons randomly, it just feels sort of so unprincipled. But those are two tiny, in the grand scheme of things, tiny algorithmic changes that have massive improvements or generated massive improvements. So it's just really amazing.
Yeah.
What I want to ask you, what did you think about ImageNet?
Oh, that's one of the most influential work in computer vision. And it's funny. So the first author, Jia Dan, is my college roommate. He was actually not doing computer vision at that time. He was in Princeton with Kai Li doing, I believe, distributed systems. And then he moved to Stanford to work with Fei-Fei. I think we were actually, doing the road trip together at that time. The first time I learned of his work in ImageNet was in CVPR 09 in Miami, I believe. And, Andrew Kapathy is also one of the co-authors. So at that time, I just feel like, okay, it's a great work. You know, it's a much larger data set than Caltech or CIFAR 100 because it's millions of images, tens of thousands of categories. It's a great data set, but it's still a classification data set. What does a larger data set buy you? It doesn't really solve the vision problem. It will help, but probably not the most important
one. And that's because you were focused on deeper understanding, right? You wanted you thought the data set was fine, but you were kind of going in the direction of more a deeper understanding of visual understanding.
Yeah, exactly. At that time, I feel like algorithm has to be the first consideration, but it turns out the scaling law holds, right? Data, compute, lots of experimentation with deep learning, of course, and then you get to, much, much higher accuracy. It's such an influential paper, ImageNet, and that triggers a tsunami of innovation on the algorithm side.
Yeah, it really did. I think, without ImageNet, we don't have AlexNet. Without AlexNet, I don't know how much longer it takes till we see this resurgence in neural networks and deep learning.
Yeah, exactly. And after that, transfer learning is a thing now. So we have been talking about representation learning for a long time. There's the top-down, kind of designed representation. There's the learned representation. But, after ImageNet, you'd start to see, VGGNet, open source, trend on, ImageNet.
Right.
And when you apply those models to applications like, object detection, various computer vision tasks, you usually pre-train from a ImageNet weights, for example.
That's right.
And that did increase the accuracy a lot.
On the breast cancer project, I seem to recall, did we even start with ImageNet weights on that?
Yes. So yeah, that's one of the hyperparameters. So we either start from random weights or start from ImageNet. It didn't make sense to me in the beginning because ImageNet is a natural images data set. It's not like mammograms, breast imaging.
Right.
It doesn't look like that. But still, if you initialize your weights from the ImageNet weights, we see a gain in accuracy.
That's right. And I think the reason is what you hinted at a moment ago. It's because when you train a model on that much natural data, you force it to learn certain type of feature extraction capabilities, whether it's, you know, contour detection or recurring patterns, corners, and things like that. And that's just helpful and useful no matter what you're doing, whatever downstream visual task. And
yeah, so exactly.
That kind of powered and enabled the transfer learning.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to change focus and talk about the shift in computer vision over the last few years. So we have the early 2000s up into the sort of, you know, early 2010s, where we have hard feature engineering based work with some type of classifier like a support vector machine or something like that. We see the deep learning revolution take hold. All of the most popular models within computer vision at that time are some type of variant of a convolutional neural network, right?
Yeah.
Which interestingly goes all the way back to the 80s. But we finally had enough data. We finally had enough compute. And we, you know, ironed out some algorithmic issues like we've already talked about, ReLU and dropout. So we get these convolutional models and we're seeing really amazing results. And then transformers.
Yeah.
Talk
and that
about
was in that. 2017, right? The attention paper.
Yeah, the attention paper 2017. You don't really see transformer-based computer vision models for a few years after that.
Right.
Talk about that.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Oh, I just realized I misspoke earlier when I say 2010s. What I meant is the 2000s, like the before the deep learning.
Right.
In 2010s, I think we saw a lot of great convolutional nets based models for detection, like VGG, ResNet as backbone, and then for object detection, we have RetinaNet, for example, that we use for document understanding. But still, you know, in computer vision, people use one type of neural nets, but for natural language processing, you typically use LSTM or other recursive structures. Transformers is what I feel kind of unite the two and makes the design even simpler. So we see more convergence there.
Right.
So with the transformers, I think, you know, because previously when we do document understanding, we would train the retina net and we will tinker with the anchor boxes so that it will literally just go into the source code and change the anchor box design there to deal with the very small tiny binding boxes in documents that's high resolution. But for when transformers is out, you know, we then transition into models like LLM, which combine both vision and NLP features, both text and visual features,
right,
that, you know, really increase the accuracy a lot. Yeah, Ron, what do you see about, you know, transformers that you know, kind of change how we work?
The transformers are unbelievably important, obviously, and I think that a couple things. One is I remember vividly in 2018, 2019. Feeling like we have transfer learning and computer vision, which is wonderful. And it was really a game changer because it meant you weren't starting every project from scratch.
Right.
NLP, you're doing natural language processing, you started every project from scratch. There wasn't really anything except for maybe like, you know, word to vec weights or something like that. That was really all you had. When transformers hit, all of a sudden, you saw so much of the upstream feature engineering or pre-processing that you would do in NLP just fall away, like we saw in computer vision. And then you had the ability to have a single architectural approach that you could leverage for both computer vision and natural language processing projects. And amazingly, that meant then we could do multimodal. Like you said, then we could combine these modalities and have a single model that was capable of understanding them both for the first time ever. That just wasn't possible before. And another fallout of that that's really important is that meant all of a sudden, you know, NLP researchers and computer vision researchers who could barely talk to each other in, let's say, 2005 could collaborate and communicate and build systems together because the lingo and the nomenclature and the and the tools and the techniques had consolidated within transformers. And so I think transformers are this is not some great insight, but they're probably the most important architectural innovation within AI of the 21st century so far. But I want to throw back to you, diffusion, right? So diffusion, diffusion as a technique, incredibly important. And we're seeing diffusion techniques. They probably first came on the scene for text to image generation, like DALL-E and things like that. Now we're seeing it for everything. We're seeing it for music generation, video generation. We're seeing it within healthcare. We just had a hackathon last weekend in the biomedical space, right? And it was all about using diffusion techniques for protein generation. Right. So what are your thoughts? So you know much more about generative models than me. I know it's a passionate area for you. What are your thoughts on diffusion?
Diffusion was a big surprise to me. It works surprisingly well. So before diffusion, people are like, you know, doing the likelihood modeling directly, trying to estimate the density directly. But, you know, diffusion is closely related to score matching. You're not directly matching where the data points are. You're matching the arrows. You're trying to match the gradient, the direction of, you know, pointing to the most dense areas. And that worked really well. Diffusion models are not tied to any specific backbones. It's not tied to ComNets or transformers, but it works really well with transformers in like the very most recent works, like the DIT, the model that's behind the Sora, you know, from OpenAI. And it's also, you know, with transformers, as long as your data can be tokenized and detokenized, and, you know, it can be encoded and decoded, you can put it, you can shove it into the transformer, and you use the diffusion training loop. It's really a training loop where you start from clean data and you corrupt it and you train the model to find a way back.
Right.
So, you know, it's crazy to think about. Now you have a neural network that predicts the gradients of a log likelihood.
Right.
But that works really well. And, you know, the I think it's fairly recent, like the diffusion models is in the 2020s.
I believe so, yeah.
But even the diffusion models are starting to be a little stale now. People are like switching to flow matching. Right. Well, you kind of can argue maybe that's, you know, kind of a special case or a generalization of a diffusion model. Yeah. So you're still trying to train the model to find a way back. But the way to do that is more flexible now. You can design the flow to get back to the clean data.
Right. Okay. So you jumped. That was the last thing I wanted to cover, and you teed it up perfectly, which is, I think flow modeling and diffusion models and these techniques are some of the things I'm most excited about because, like you said, you can take a process where it may look just utterly impossible to go from sort of point A to point Z, but you break it down into steps and train a model to take these little steps one by one. Yeah. And then it almost seems like magic is the result, right? Mm. I think protein folding might be one of the most important examples because this was hands down one of the most important unsolved problems within biology. And, you know, we've talked to a lot of biologists recently, and it's just considered to be a solved problem at this point. So what are your thoughts? We'll wrap up like this. I'm dying to know, what are you most excited about within AI and computer vision, whether it's some unsolved problem, some new techniques, or just an area where you think we're making progress and you are excited to be involved and see where we can take it?
Well, there's such a great question, and I think there are probably more than one. So there's the multimodal trend of the, you know, now we start from language model or LLMs to vision language models, and then more recently there's the I think people call it unimodal. So like, you know, any to any. So there's a recent work called Transfusion that kind of, you know, even combine transformers, like the autoregressive generation with the diffusion type of generation in parallel. So that is right. Able to like, you know, hey, your inputs can be text, image, video, audio, music, and your output is text, video, you know, robotic action. You just switch on and off and you know, because you know most of the business data have multiple modalities. You have transactions, text, images. So such a model, you only need one big model to learn kind of all of your business, which is really exciting. Another direction is robotics and embedded vision systems, which is, you know, we see, you know, Figure and, you know, Boston Dynamics, you know, a lot of the computer vision models are now applied to systems like that to make the robotics more intelligent, able to navigate and help us in our lives. I'm also super excited about that.
Yeah, diffusion, I think, has unlocked robotics in a way that nobody really fully expected. And we're seeing giant steps in robotics, I think, because of that process.
Right.
Yeah. Any other further thoughts, anything you're really excited about in the future you want to wrap up and discuss?
We didn't talk about nerve yet. That's another really interesting topic.
Like right.
The neural radiance fields, the 3D reconstruction and Gaussian splats. But you know, that probably takes a long time to dive into. But that's another kind of very surprising and very exciting development over the last few years.
All right, I'll tell you what, we'll do another episode soon. We'll come on and we'll dig into that.
Sounds good.
Zizi, thank you so much. This was just a ball and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Ron. Glad to be here.
Thank you for listening to Hidden Layers. This series is hosted by Kung Fu AI, a management consulting and engineering firm focused exclusively on artificial intelligence. If you have any questions or thoughts about today's episode, or if you know someone we should feature, please visit us at kungfu.ai.